I hope I'm coming through to those of you in the back. If not, I'll turn the volume up. How are we doing? Coming through? All right. Well, today our assignment in this seminar is to focus on the subject of premarital counseling. I need to preface this study with a couple of my own personal observations. And I know that's not a good way to start usually, but you have to know where I'm coming from, because I not only am a father and now a grandfather, I have seen my own children marry, but I have worked most of my life with college-age young people, and they will date, and they will get serious, and they will marry. And in that context, I've had the opportunity to spend a lot of time face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball, with couples who are anticipating marriage. And in all of that, you have a lot of opportunity to search your own heart and soul. You have a lot of opportunity to search the scriptures. And I have, over the years, come to some observations that I trust will be helpful to us today. But I need to begin with a couple of very personal observations. And the first one is one which I would rather not say, but I will say it because it burns heavily in my spirit. I believe personally that some of the greatest evidences, symptoms of worldliness in the church are the way we date and the way we marry and the way we raise our kids. In those areas, we're not a snap different from the unsaved world around us. Let's face it, folks. We have sold ourselves down the river. Not long ago, there was a major editorial in a Los Angeles Times in which the editor, who had a very sharp pen, expressed himself very, very well, wrote an editorial to evangelical Christians because he had just read the research results, nationwide research among evangelical Christians on certain sociological matters. And in essence, what he said in this editorial was, "Now, you evangelical Christians are always telling us that we need to listen to your gospel. But he said, "I just looked at this research. And this research in North America among evangelical Christians shows that the rate of abortion and the rate of divorce is precisely the same in the evangelical community as it is in the larger culture." Now, he said, when you have differences in your lives in these important areas, then you come talk to me about your gospel. But as long as you're no better off than we are in these crucial areas, don't talk to me about your gospel. It obviously doesn't mean much. But I must admit, when I read things like that, it makes me wince and hurt, because I am an evangelical, and I don't have any qualms about standing up and identifying with evangelical Christianity. I am one. But when I see statistics like this, it alarms me. It used to be that we sat in our conservative assemblies and looked at the world outside and said, "Ooh, they really have their family problems, don't they?" We don't say that anymore, because we've got them. And there's scarcely a family that I know, even in very conservative circles, that hasn't been deeply touched, closely touched by significant crises in the domestic scene. And it's very, very obvious to me that we need to do some very, very careful biblical thinking in these areas. We have not done the teaching we ought to do from the scriptures. We have not structured our family life and our assembly life in such a way as to meet needs. And I personally believe that if evangelicals are going to keep their head above water in our Western world, we're going to have to get our house in order as far as domestic things are concerned. And the only way we can do that is to get back to the Bible. I'm convinced of that. I've unloaded my concern. Let's hurry up into this matter of premarital counseling. Tremendously needed ministry. Tremendously needed. In fact, most of the people that I talk to when I have a chance to talk about how things happened when they got married, quite often I talk to people who have had absolutely no counsel whatsoever. Quite often I talk to people who, if they had any counsel at all, the person who officiated in their wedding gave them a little devotional homily and checked out to see whether they were both believers, and if they were both Christians, boy, at least we're relieved that they're both believers, and so we rushed them to the altar. And my conviction is that we dare not assume that our young people are entering into marriage in a biblical way. That's a tragically false assumption. And if there's any ministry that needs to be revitalized in evangelical Christian circles, it's the ministry of premarital counseling. Now, some overview settings here. First of all, I hope that as you approach this matter, you realize that there are some foundational issues biblically and theologically that you need to have straight in your own mind. Because if you don't, you're going to find some tremendous limitations in trying to minister to a couple that is headed for the altar. And that includes, first of all, the fact that marriage is a creation ordinance. It is not an ordinance of the church. Marriage was here long before the church began. Marriage will be here after the church is whisked off to glory. Marriage is a creation ordinance. And therefore, it is God's purpose for all of mankind, and it is God's plan. I have seen a cartoon in which you see some semi-ape-like creature peering out of his cave. He sees another semi-ape-like creature that turns him on, so he runs after her, bops her on the head with his club, drags her by the hair back into his cave, and somehow or another, over the eons of time, they decide that if she throws the bones out, he'll go kill some more dinosaurs or whatever. And that's about the way we think. And I think if we are not convinced that marriage is God's plan, that he built a plan of marriage into the very foundation of the race, because it was a creation ordinance, marriage was built into the creative process. And if we don't understand marriage from the foundation up, we're going to have a very, very difficult time helping people in the world in which we live. A very difficult time. Not only that, I believe that there is, of course, a matter of individual development and usefulness involved here. Domestic life touches all of us. You are either a child or a parent most of your life. And I think it's important that we recognize that what happens in our homes has a great deal to do with our lives. I grew up on a farm, and I often saw calves born, and within minutes sometimes they're on their feet and running. In the better cows, we took the calf away from the cow as soon as it was born. And they never had personality problems. We never had to call psychiatrists in. It was very interesting how normally those calves grew up and they never even were around their mother. Don't try that with a human being, or you'll be in deep, deep trouble. We are immeasurably different from the mere animals, and one of the things that God has built into human experience is at least 2 decades of growth and development. Most animals have lived their whole lifespan and are dead long before a human born at the same time even reaches maturity. There is nothing that the psychologists have been able to prove is instinctual in human behavior. And these years of development, these decades of development, are incredibly important in what the individual becomes and how they live all of their lives. God places great priority on the developmental process in human experience. He places great responsibility on parents and on Christian leaders. And part of that responsibility is preparing people to understand God's style of marriage and God's plan for family life and helping people move that direction. We have not done a good job of that in evangelical circles. We need to get our house in order. Obviously, spiritual usefulness depends upon your domestic life. In fact, even qualifications for being an elder have something to do with one's conduct in one's home. And we could go on and describe many, many ways, both positively and negatively, in which an individual's family life, their attitude toward their involvement with the domestic scene, either qualifies them, enhances their ministry, or disqualifies them, or degrades their ministry. Your usefulness to God has a lot of relationship with your domestic dimension of life. God made it that way, and I think for a reason. And then, of course, God has order in society. It is he who told us how human life should be structured, how we should live, and part of that has to do with the role responsibilities that he reveals in his word, specifically for the home and for church life. I remind you very briefly here, even though this is not our subject today, that the roles in the scripture are always spoken of in either the indicative or the imperative. The roles are never in the Bible optional or suggestive. For example, children obey your parents if you think they are right. Huh? No. You see, that's the language of option. When it comes to roles, the Bible never uses the language of option or suggestion. Children obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Now, you wives, if you're the demure, retiring type, then you be submissive to your husband. If not, you work it out some other way, right? No. You see, that's the language of option. What does the Bible say? The Bible says, wives, be in submission to your husbands as unto the Lord. Now, you husbands, if you're the strong leader type, then you be the head of your home. And if you're not that type of person, then you work it out some other way, right? No. What does the Bible say? The husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church. Now, I may not function that way. I may tragically default. But the Bible still says, as a husband, I am the head of the wife. It's a fact. The language of roles in the scripture is always either a statement of fact or a command. It is never the language of suggestion or option. And one of the ways in which a true evangelical Christian will most pointedly butt heads with a world that's going down the tubes fast is in the area of role responsibilities. Because our culture, we like to hang loose, and roles become very, very fluid in our society. And nobody tells me what to do in our culture or how to live. Not in our culture. And look at what's happening in our important relationships. There are major cultural changes. And I just listed some here for you. You're aware of these as well as I. Obviously, every day we live, there's less and less respect culture-wise for what the Bible says and what the Bible teaches. More and more hostility toward careful biblical ideas and living. We're moving more and more toward the nuclear family, even to the exclusion of the extended family. And I know situations in which even grandparents don't dare even say a word to their grandchildren, because the parents are telling their kids, I'm the one that tells you what to do, and nobody else tells you what to do. Which is a tragic thing, of course, because God's order and government involve a lot of authorities in our lives. And parental authority is there, but it's only part of it. The authority of spiritual leadership, obedient to civil authorities, all of these are a part of God's program. But culturally, in our radical individualism, we're getting away from that. And less involvement of extended families. Movement toward fluid roles. My, oh, my, what a sweeping change has happened in our culture in terms of roles. Change in sexual morality. It's absolutely alarming what has happened in our Western world. From the top to the bottom, we have become the kind of nation that would make Sodom blush. And, of course, in our attitude toward children, we're at sea. We don't seem to have any qualms about murdering a child before birth by the millions. God help us. And yet 15 minutes after they're born, we will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to keep a little child alive. And I say, what form of insanity has seized us in our culture? And to many, children are a bother. When I got married, which wasn't eons ago, by the way, when I got married, I was one of the last of the group of young people that sort of hung together and ran around together to marry. And remember those thrilling years when we were going through the dating and marrying. We were in each other's weddings and all of these great things that were a part of young adult life. And we did a lot of talking. You know, I can't remember one single discussion in those years of my life when we really seriously raised any question as to whether we wanted to have children after we got married. It was just assumed. This is one of the good things about getting married. God gives you a family. It was just built into our thinking. In the last 10 years, I haven't talked to one single couple that didn't have major questions about if they wanted children and certainly when they wanted children. I've gone from 0% discussion of this to 100% discussion of this in my lifetime. And I'm trying to roll with the punch. Our attitude toward children is quite striking. My daughter's expecting her fifth. And I cannot tell you how many times, being with her with four little children and another one obviously being born, that I have seen people look at her with great disdain, that she would have the audacity to bring all of those children into this terrible world. Some things have changed, folks, very dramatically in our culture. These are only a few of those changes. We rush on. Why people fail in marriage? Actually, this is the result of some research that Howard Hendricks did among a whole host of evangelical pastors and counselors nationwide. And I know that if you read normal discussions about marriage failure, you will find that things like finance and sexual problems rate right at the top. But these are more basic issues. And these are the kinds of things that Christian counselors and Christian pastors are saying are basic to marriages that fail, that break up. And that has to do with improper choices. Sometimes people who were thinking people, who were caring people around the couple knew that it was doomed from the beginning because of a number of reasons. Sometimes unrealistic expectations, sometimes inadequate preparation, and characteristically just plain disobedience to the Word of God. The interesting thing about these four major reasons why marriages go on the rocks, according to evangelical leaders, is that most of them are remediable. We could do something about this. And that's why I'm glad we have a session on premarital counseling here today. Because that's one of the things in which we can do something about the domestic problems we have. If there's ever an area of life in which an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, it's this area of life, to be sure. To be sure. Now, some thoughts about premarital counseling specifically. First of all, you can help a couple in the area of legal and situational requirements. You don't have to play paralegal. There are certain things that are a part of life, and in a dynamic, changing society like ours, you will need to keep up with the issue, and you will need to do some investigating yourself, because legal requirements vary from state to state and from province to province. But you can help young people headed for marriage by helping them in these areas. The matter of licensure, where they get the license, how much time they have in purchasing the license, do they need a blood test in order to get a license, for how long a period of time is the license valid. In most places, marriage licenses have a period of validity, and you can't buy a license now if you're going to get married in June. And not only that, sometimes we have problems of qualifications of the person who officiates. Particularly in our assemblies, we have these problems. Let me just quickly mention them to you. You see, in a typical church situation, a couple just goes to their pastor and say, we want to get married. They never give this a thought. But in our assemblies, characteristically, the people who get asked to officiate in a marriage are in one of two categories. Either they're a person in the local church, characteristically an elder or a youth leader, that is not an ordained minister, or they ask some full-time worker that they met at camp 6 years ago, or a teacher they had at Emmaus 2 years ago, to officiate in their marriage, but they live in another state or maybe even another country. And because of these idiosyncrasies in our assemblies, the question of who is qualified to marry someone in a given place becomes very important. And so you'll need, as you talk with young couples, you will need to encourage them to check these matters out very, very carefully. You'll need to steer them down to the clerk at the local marriage license bureau or office at the county seat and get the details about the license, what is required, the timing factors. And you will need to help them with these details in some cases because they're not sure where to turn. And certainly with regard to the qualifications of one who officiates, you will need to check this out very carefully. By the way, that can also be given to you by the clerk at the marriage license bureau at the county seat where the marriage is to be consummated. So you will need to check that out as well. It varies a great deal. For example, the state of Illinois is one of the most lax in North America. The laws of the state of Illinois essentially still say that if the couple considers you to be a minister, you can marry them, period. Case closed. Which means they could go in and buy their marriage license, walk out on the street, grab the first person that comes by and say, "Will you marry us? We consider you..." Yes, amen, may it be so. And they're all over. It's all finished. That's pretty lax. That's pretty lax. In the state of Ohio, you will need a license from the state. And to get that license, you will need to present credentials. And then after you've got the license, you will need to get a stamp. It's like, sort of like a hunting stamp or a fishing license. You need a stamp for every county within the state that you officiate in. That's pretty specific. So there are a great deal of variations in the 50 states and across Canada as to what is required by way of qualification. Remember this, however. Legally, ordination is the equivalent, I should say, commendation is the equivalent of ordination. Legally, that is true. The second thing you need to keep in mind is that, to my knowledge, every state and every province will recognize a person's qualifications to marry if that person has a written document, a to whom it may concern letter, from a local church signed by more than one person, in which the letter specifically states that this letter authenticates such and such a person to represent this local church in officiating in marriages. And that kind of a statement from even a very small local church signed by more than one person will legally qualify you to officiate in marriages, to my knowledge, in every state and in every province. And that's not too difficult to do, to get a letter of approval representing a local church as one who has been approved by that local church to officiate in marriages. I'm grateful for that option that we have. We hurry on. In the process of premarital counseling, you will want to assess something of background and preparation, remembering that preparation for marriage does not begin when they sit down to counsel with you. Preparation for marriage began when mom and dad carried that baby home from the hospital, and the climate of the home in which they grew up, the way mom treated dad, the way dad talked to mom, on and on and on. All of those things were very important preparation for marriage that was going on long before you have a chance to talk to this couple. Not only that, a lot of preparation was going on in the life of the local church. And some of the wrong jokes that some of us preachers have told from the platform, and a lot of other things that go on in the local church that degrade marriage, that cause people to think unbiblically about marriage. We do a lot of things that are not really good preparation. And I think it's well that we assess when we talk to a couple where they are in their thinking, how they're coming to this relationship, and get a little bit of the formation of their thinking and their attitude toward marriage, whether they have had any real careful teaching about biblical marriage. Many, many, many young people lack that almost completely. I teach a course at Emmaus in marriage and family life. I'm amazed what my students tell me. Even some of the simplest things we talk about, and they sit there with their mouth hanging open as though they had never heard it. And maybe they weren't listening. I'm inclined to think that we're not doing much teaching. For example, I can remember a whole series of messages on Abraham that I heard once in my commending assembly, and the preacher never once mentioned his marriage or family life. Now, if you preach a series of messages on Abraham and totally avoid his marriage and family life, you've done a fancy piece of footwork. But it's very, very easy for us to miss these dimensions of biblical teaching. In fact, I find there aren't many people who are willing to even preach on the subject. There are only a few of us who are willing to rush in where angels fear to tread. Why, I don't know, but the fact of the matter is we are not getting much systematic teaching. And one of the things you can do to help young people prepare for marriage is to assess where they are in their thinking and try to get some help to them, at least at the time when they're interested in marriage. And the motive to work in a relationship with another person, the motive to think about marriage in a careful way, is probably at an all-time high just before they get married. So strike while the iron is hot and get some teaching there in one way or another. One of the ways you can do that is to assign some reading. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And the other way, of course, is to plan to get them involved in some kind of a teaching-learning situation which may help them. By the way, Emmaus has a very good correspondence course on this subject. There is sometimes possibility of group counseling. I remember one delightful experience in the Chicago area. There were three South Side assemblies that suddenly showed up with seven couples who were all getting married within a few weeks of each other. And so I had the privilege of going down there once a week for a month or so to just spend some time with these 14 young adults and talk about marriage. Now, there are a lot of things you can't do in this context. You can't really do careful premarital counseling in the group context, but you can do a lot of things by way of teaching and by way of awakening some sense of needs and identifying areas for them to think about and talk about as individual couples. Sometimes there is the possibility of a group ministry here that you may also want to consider, particularly if you're working with young people. As far as procedure, your commitment, there are two spheres here that you want to think about. One is corporately. I believe that the whole area of family life could be greatly enhanced if, as a congregation of believers, as the local church, we would give some careful thought to this. A number of years ago, we were plunged into this. The assembly we were in the Chicago area had a building that was right on the corner of Chicago and First Avenue, a very beautiful church type of building. A lot of people passed that way. And because it was a very visible and a nice-looking building, we had all kinds of requests of people who wanted to get married there. And for a year and a half, I was the one who kept the book in which we recorded all the events that happened at the chapel. And I got so weary of talking to people who wanted to get married there that I was distraught. And in the process, we had to do some thinking, first of all as a group of elders, and then as a congregation. And to make a long story short, we concluded that we considered marriage far too sacred. We didn't want to become a marriage outpost or a quickie marrying station. And in the Chicago area, with a strong Roman Catholic presence, there were always many couples who the church wouldn't touch. And they thought, well, this church, they're just a little independent place. They'll let us get married there. And we concluded that we felt marriage was far too sacred to just become a marrying station. And so as a congregation, we set up some certain standards. And this building will not be used for a wedding unless such and such some conditions were met, including premarital counseling that the elders approved of. And some other things that we set up that sort of did a weeding out process, you see, when people thought they were going to get married there. We said, well, here are the standards of this congregation, and if you're going to use this building, here are the standards you must meet. And I think we could reinforce this whole matter of the sanctity and the sacredness of marriage by doing this. One of the reasons why at Emmaus we require a couple to have counseling sessions before they even announce their engagement. And people say, ooh, that's pretty thick, that's pretty... Well, the fact of the matter is, if we can work together to get things moving in a biblical direction and get people to think about their biblical responsibilities in this area of life, let's do it. Let's do it. We tend to work against each other, by the way, you know? For example, I can remember days when my kids were the only ones that came to prayer meeting. And do you know somebody would inevitably pat him on the head and say, oh, Johnny, you poor little guy, this is awfully late for you to be up. And I'd want to shake them and say, hey, help me. Don't work against me. At least he's at prayer meeting. Your kids are at home watching 15 murders on TV while my kids are here. And they're not going to get to bed any earlier than mine. So don't pity my child for coming to prayer meeting. I didn't say that, of course. Dale Carnegie says you don't win friends and influence people by saying things like that. But we can work against each other if we're not careful. And I think there are ways that we can work corporately to encourage and to reinforce some sacred biblical thinking about the issues of marriage. Individually, of course, you will need to come to your own convictions. Many of you may want to work as a couple, a husband-wife couple in premarital counseling. It can be a tremendously effective thing for husbands and wives to work as a couple. Not only that, you may want to set some of your own individual patterns and standards. Let me just tell you where I am in this. You don't need to do this. I'll tell you where I am. In my thinking about this matter of a premarital ministry, I always, of course, I shouldn't say always, there have been a few occasions when I knew the couple well enough that I didn't need to do this. Characteristically, I delay a response as to whether or not I will officiate until I've had some time to spend with them in counseling. That may seem a bit thick, but I have far too much sense of responsibility. You know, the Bible does not say a minister has to officiate in a marriage. This is a service we perform that is culturally oriented. But there is a sense of responsibility, and I would rather, in most cases, have delayed saying whether yes or no I will or will not officiate. Because after all, they had a free choice. They don't have to ask me. And if I don't do it, there are countless other people out there who will. So it isn't that I'm saying they can't get married. I can't say that. That's not my prerogative. But I can say if I'm going to officiate, I'll wait until we have some time to spend together. And then I'll give you my final decision. By the way, that helps to enforce a sanctity sense of marriage. Now, it also helps me in another matter, and that is the matter of a freedom to be frank. You don't have to come to talk to me. You had that freedom, now give me a freedom. The freedom to be as frank as I feel I need to be in what I see in your relationship. And I recall the first time that I said to a couple, you know, look, this is not healthy, kids. This is not really a husband-wife relationship. This is a mother-son relationship, and I'm very uncomfortable with this. And it shook them up. And eventually, within a few days, believe it or not, they called it off. And would you believe it? They each ended up marrying somebody else. And to this day, every time I see one or the other, they will take occasion to get close and say, thanks, Dan. Thanks. It was hard to do. And I'm not one of these easy confrontational people. That's why it helps me to ask for the privilege of being frank about what I see in a relationship. Not only that, I will say that I will not officiate in a marriage unless there has been premarital counseling. I mean, I have to do it. As I told someone here, even as a father, before officiating in my own kids' weddings, I said, now look, I'll spend time in counseling with you, but you must have someone else give you premarital counseling, not just me, because I cannot always be objective with my own flesh and blood. But I do believe it's important, and I do not officiate in a marriage unless there has been premarital counseling involved. Not only that, I don't want to officiate in a marriage unless there's biblical content in the vows. I consider vows to be the heart of the marriage. And for better or worse, richer or poorer, in sickness and health, these words give us warm fuzzies, but they can be very egalitarian, and they can be very devoid of biblical content. And if I'm going to officiate in a marriage as a matter of conscience, I say we need to have some biblical content in these vows. And if a young man would not be willing to vow to take the headship of his home, I'm not sure I want to be a part of the process. Frankly, that's how strongly I feel about biblical roles. And we could go on and on. So you will need to determine your own standards there and your own involvement in this process, particularly if it involves officiating in marriages. But I think that as you look this over, you will come to some very important convictions for yourself. My final requirement is that they commit themselves specifically and openly to the permanence of marriage. I do not see divorce as an option for Christians. I do not believe if they go into marriage leaving the back door open that it's a truly biblical marriage. And if they are both not committed to the permanence of marriage, I don't touch it with a 10-foot pole. I'm terribly narrow. Pardon me. Arrangements. How do you make arrangements in this premarital counseling business? Oh, we're rushing on here. First of all, there will be a point in which they talk to you or express some way that they'd like to get some help from you. Or they want to talk to you and your wife, or however they express it. And in that first contact, there are some things that you can accomplish right there on the spot. You can talk about the date to see how soon it's coming, how quickly all of this has to be worked out. You can talk about at least set a couple of times when you can meet with them with the option of more. But you can start by a little bit of specific date setting, and that gives them your commitment to try to help them and gets the process started. You may want to give some reading assignments. It may be that there will be some very good material that you know about that you would like to see them read. By the way, I will have a whole stack of bibliographies over here. And if you're interested in a bibliography, please feel free to take one. I don't want to just give them out because not everybody is that interested. But this is very selective, and you'll still have to be selective within this bibliography, but there are some good volumes available that many times focus on certain areas of need that may come up as you're doing the premarital counseling. But there may be some general works that you will want to recommend that they read as a part of their input. Not only that, I give them a premarital counseling schedule. Gentlemen, will you give these out at this point, please? This schedule that you're getting a copy of is designed for two purposes. And I use this in premarital counseling. I give it to the couple in my very first contact with them. Actually, what it is a simple device that they take in hand, and the two of them together sit down and work through this. Doesn't involve me at all. The two of them sit down and work through this together. By the way, while you're getting this, let me say this used to be produced professionally. It came into public domain, and I took the liberty then to do some modifying. And so I've tried to give Mr. Dr. Otto the credit for it because the basic work was his. I've done some modifying. And if you find this helpful, I would gladly send copies to you if you communicate with me. It's not in a bin, so I don't sell them. But if you feel this is helpful, you might get more from me in the days ahead. But what this is a simple device that accomplishes two things. First of all, it's a checklist for the couple. And they sit down and work through it. And at least it gives them the... it's sort of like taking a grocery list to the store. Have you ever gone to the store, you didn't make a list, and you get home and say, oh, I forgot the milk. Or I forgot the potatoes or something. Well, if you got a list, it helps. Because then you can check things off. Well, this becomes sort of a checklist of important things for a couple to think through and talk through and pray through as they prepare for marriage. And that in itself is valuable. You'd be amazed how many couples show up with an awful lot of things that they should talk about that they haven't talked about, and they're on the brink of marriage. So this becomes a checklist. And it's not complete. There are always places for you or for them to add other items. But it deals with 12 different areas of important matters, and it becomes the second thing it does is as they work through this together, they can respond. And at each point they can say, well, we've worked this out pretty well, or we need to talk about this more, or at the end to say, we'll want separate counseling on these, or we may want some reading material on this, or we may want to talk about this after we're married or something. In other words, this becomes diagnostic. And as the counselor, you can take this then and look through it, because in the next time they come to talk with you, they bring it along, then you can look through this and it becomes diagnostic. It highlights areas that you need to focus on and spend more time with. And it also indicates areas where they, to their satisfaction, have talked about it pretty well, and you can save time by not necessarily delving into those areas. So this is both a checklist for the couple as well as diagnostic for you. And there's nothing sacred about this except the biblical intent. But if you feel that this kind of thing would be helpful and you need these, if you want, I'll gladly send some to you. But I find this a very helpful tool because, again, to me as a counselor, it gives me the satisfaction that at least I've prodded their thinking to talk about important matters together. And it also gives a diagnostic opportunity to look down and see those areas where they say, ooh, we need help in this area, or we need help in, or we can't agree on this. And if they do this sincerely, those areas will be flagged, and you can pick them up very readily and really get right, cut to the chase as far as getting to important issues in premarital counseling. So in that first contact, I would give them this. I also give them copies of the Taylor-Johnson Temperament Analysis. And I don't know how many of you know about that instrument, whether you, any of you have certified to use it. It's a professional material, but it's not highly psychological, and it's a very, very good instrument to use when you're dealing with intrapersonal relationships. And I like to give them a copy of the TJTA with the crisscross option that they work on and get it to me before they come in for further counseling. I, in that first occasion, characteristically inquire about any kind of immediate or pressing problems. And sometimes, even at that point, when a couple comes and first says they would like to spend some time in premarital counseling, there may be one or two real burning issues that have driven them to seek some counseling. And it's good to know up front what the driving factors have been. And I say that for several reasons. One is, you know, that stress and problems can be motivational. And you don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. One of the problems in premarital counseling is indifference. And when there are problems, and problems are acute enough to drive somebody to look for help, that's an opportunity to help. And you don't want to ignore that. You don't want to let those signals go. So right up front, you may raise a question, even in the first informal contact, if there are issues that are particularly pressing that you should be aware of and that you should plan to focus on. Because that will help you to avoid, as I say, killing the goose that lays the golden egg, which, of course, is temporary anxiety. And you might want to get just a little bit of the history of the relationship if you don't know them. And, of course, you certainly will, early in the session, want to raise questions about family attitude and family involvement. Do your parents know about this? Have you told your parents? Ooh, that's terribly old-fashioned, but old-fashioned people like me tend to do things like that. How about your respective families? Are they aware of your plans? Are they happy about it? You know, some of these early contacts can give you some indications of areas that you may need to work on in the counseling process. Later contacts, personally, I do not have a fixed number of sessions and do not have a fixed curriculum or schedule to follow. Now, some of you may fault me on that. I know people that do their premarital counseling very, very systematically, and I always admire systematic people. But I find that premarital counseling is sort of like working mechanical work on a car. It's such a complex mechanism, and it requires so many tools, and there are so many possible problems that there is no single formula that solves all the problems in my car. And I don't think that a premarital counseling ministry necessarily follows the same program, because people are different, their needs are different, their backgrounds are different. And so for that reason, I don't have it carefully prescribed. But one thing I do, always, and that is I always set a session with just the couple, one or the other, just the guy or just the girl. And I tell them why. I tell them that the reason why I want to see just the girl or just the guy in a separate session, two reasons. First of all, I can talk straight to them about their responsibilities without the other one being there. See? For example, if I sit there and talk to this young lady about her responsibilities and being in submission to her husband and that, and he's sitting there, you know, in the back of her mind, she'd say, boy, Bill's put him up to this, he's cheering him on, you know, see, or whatever, or vice versa. I find that it's easier to talk straight about some delicate issues if you're just talking to one or the other. The second reason why I talk with them individually is to give them an opportunity to bring something up with me that they would be uncomfortable to bring up with the other person there. They say, wait a minute, that tells you something. Yes, it does. But I'm absolutely amazed how many times in premarital counseling, one or the other will bring up something that they frankly would not have talked about if their intended spouse was there. Now, that tells you something, because I'm not marrying them. And they'll talk with me about something that they're not able to talk about with the person you're going to marry. That tells you something, right? But it becomes important to give that outlet, that opportunity. And for that reason, in the scheduling of times that I meet with them, I always schedule one time with just the bride and just the groom, separately, for those two reasons. Also, this I've come to very recently, and that is I like to schedule a post-marriage session as a part of the whole process and set this up ahead of time. So that not only are we going to meet three or four times, five times, maybe before the marriage occurs, but set up one about 2 months after they're married. And wow, if we had time, I could talk to you about some tremendously significant things that have unfolded in these post-marital sessions. And many times a couple has told me that if they didn't already have this session set up, they may not have had the sense to get some help at that time in some of their adjustment problems. But because the session was already set up, and remember, in those premarital months, the motive to work at a relationship is at an all-time high, and the dating process in the Western world is a best foot forward process, and once you're married, once you've said I do, then we tend to relax. That's the problem with most marriages, and then we become just like we really are. See? And so it helps to have that session already set up, because sometimes in those early weeks and months of marriage, there are adjustment issues which can best be dealt with before they frustrate and linger them too long. And so to set up at least one post-marital session at the time you're setting up your premarital counseling sessions, I recommend that to you. There are different levels of expectation. And, of course, the main thing in our culture is that we have expectation for the other and not for ourselves. It's one of the crazy inconsistencies of the radical individualism of our Western world. And it's one of the most destructive things in marriage. Couples go into marriage, the girl, for example, realizing this guy is somewhat of a lazy slob, but, boy, wait till I get my hooks in him. I'll shape him up. Well, that can be deadly. That can be deadly. And if you're not satisfied with the person that you stand alongside of at the altar and say, I do with, at that point, you may be headed for some very deep trouble, because the expectation that you are going to change that person becomes one of the most deadly potions that you can pour into a marriage relationship. And the focus, of course, in premarital counseling is, what are your expectations of yourself? One of the things I characteristically add, what do you think, when I talk with them individually? Bill, tell me, what do you think is the major adjustment you're going to have to make in marriage? Mary, what do you think is the major change or adjustment you're going to have to make in marriage? Okay. To try to get the focus there, because that's biblical, you know, as expressed in the sentiment of the old spirituals. Not the preacher, it's not the deacon, but it's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. And if there's going to be change focus in your life, let it be on the changes God needs to make in your life. That's the safe biblical way to do it. And you can get that mindset pretty well focused in the premarital process if you have that in view. Realize, too, that there are levels of commitment. I am personally convinced that marriage is not a single commitment. I believe a healthy biblical marriage, as the relationship develops, is really a series of commitments. For example, here's a couple, and he's the kind that when there are problems, he just clams up. And she's the kind when there are problems, she needs to talk. See? Wow. And you talk about this. You work at this communication issue. And one of the things they need to do is, he needs to make the commitment, yes, God helping me, I will talk. I won't just clam up and give you the old silent treatment. God helping me, I'll talk. And she needs to make the commitment, God helping me, I'll realize that we can't always talk about this right now, that we'll have to do it at the right time, right place. And so, yes, Bill, I won't drive this. You know, there may be a whole series of commitments that really come about in the process of a healthy relationship. And they need to see that. And, of course, there are levels of disclosure. And we don't know much about this in our Western world because we're a very plastic society. But there's a classic statement, lovers will have naked bodies, friends will have naked souls. And the problem with most marriages is they start out as lovers and they have never been and unfortunately never become friends. And there needs to be a level of disclosure far beyond that which many, many, many couples are thinking of. And the disclosure of self is one of the glorious potentials in a truly biblical marriage. It's one of the lacking ingredients in most Western marriages. And you need to think about levels of disclosure with them. Goals and objectives, wow. See, it must be a process of reality testing. In the Western world, there's a lot of infatuation, which people think is real love. It's the fool's goal of real love. And it's love is not blind, but infatuation is blind. And there needs to be some reality testing. And every good relationship goes through a certain amount of disillusionment unless the person is ideally perfect. Anybody here like that? Ideally perfect? No, not I. Well, unless you're ideally perfect, and unless the person you marry is also ideally perfect, every relationship is going to go through a certain amount of disillusionment. And there's nobody who knows me any better than my wife. And praise God, she stood the test of disillusionment. It's a wonderful thing to know that. You're going to say that too, huh, Nate?
Mark Worsley asked that question one time, and a man stood Yes.
Ah, yes. Ooh, that's tough, isn't it? Hey. Not only that, there must be an opportunity for the development of communication skills. There used to be a cartoon that I had on a bulletin board. It got kind of dog-eared and worn, and it disappeared. But a single frame. You're looking into the back of the limousine, and the bride is there with her veil thrown back and rice in her hair, and the groom is there with his tie askew and rice in his hair, and they're rushing away from the marriage. And the caption under it is, "Well, now, tell me about yourself." And we laugh at that, but I squirm with discomfort because I am amazed at how many issues have never been discussed and some of the communication problems. One of the things we need to do in our premarital counseling is to help people with communication skills, particularly to deal with issues of problem solving, conflict resolution. How do they handle issues in which they do not think alike? And there are a lot of ways to do that. Just a quick illustration. What are we, shooting for 4 o'clock here? Just a quick illustration. For example, you can use open-ended proverbs. Here's Bill and Mary sitting there and say, "Bill and Mary, I'm going to give you a proverb. And I want each of you to tell me what it means." And you, of course, choose an open-ended proverb. "The rolling stones gather no moss." So Bill says, "That means if you keep moving, you never get rusty." Mary says, No. "That means if you never put down roots, you won't amount to much." They got a problem. So then you sit back and say, "Okay, you've got 3 minutes to talk together. I'm just going to get out of this now. You talk together. You decide which it is, and then you'll tell me." And you just sit back and let them go at it. Because initially they don't agree, see? And the important thing is not what answer they give you, frankly. The important thing is that you see a process of dialogue between them in which they do not think alike. And you learn some important things about communication. And you see some interesting tactics that one uses on the other. Tears and anger and everything else to try to get the other person to think like they think. And that's the important thing. It tends to unlock some areas of communication and conflict resolution that you need to work with. Very, very important. I am convinced that in normal people, thinking people, healthy people, it is inevitable that any healthy, normal couple are going to have issues that they have to grapple with in which they don't think alike. It, I believe, is inevitable. We must learn to deal with issues in which we do not think alike and to deal with them in loving, gracious, biblical ways, and that's very, very important. Exploring the problems of marriage. Make sure it's an educational experience. You know, not every experience is a learning experience. That takes insight and input and involvement in order to make it a learning experience. And, of course, you hopefully will build a relationship with a couple that will last for a long time. In the context of the local church, this is very, very, very vital to cultivate and to strengthen those pastoral ties in the process of premarital counseling. Assessing readiness. There are a number of issues here, and you have in your hand a number of questions that you may want to use to assess the reasons why they are marrying, if they've even thought about this, what their goals are, to find out similarities and dissimilarities in their backgrounds, the history of their courtship. Has it been a tranquil courtship? Has it been a stormy courtship? All of these things are helpful in getting insights into areas where they may need some help. And, of course, there may be external circumstances of pressures upon them in the fact of their marriage and the timing of their marriage. And these are the kinds of things you need to see. And for sure, there needs to be a careful focus on the level of spiritual maturity. We're skipping over the auto content because you have that in your hand. Important areas for the couple to think together, and you may want to look at that. Let's go down to the next point, and that is some suggestions for passages of Scripture. And there's only suggestion. These are very, very basic. But both for your encouragement to them to get into the Word of God together, or maybe for you to spend some time in a dialogue kind of teaching-learning situation. So look at, personally, you've got to get back to those foundational Scriptures in Genesis 1 and 2. If you don't, you don't understand biblical marriage. Now, you need to include some of the biographic studies. Boy, in the Old Testament, God pulls back the tent flaps of an awful lot of families. That gives us some insights into the dynamics of family life, both good and bad. And that can be very, very helpful. and of course the key Old Testament and New Testament passages. You may want to explore these very, very carefully with them. One of the things I would suggest personally, especially if the couple has any inclination toward Bible study, is get them into 2 Corinthians 6, the classic passage on the unequal yoke. There are five words used there. In the process of warning us against an unequal yoke, the apostle really describes what the equal yoke is like. It is a partnership. It is a fellowship. It involves accord. It involves having things in common. It involves agreement. And have them do a word study on these five terms. Because while warning us against an unequal yoke, the apostle really describes the equal yoke. I would hate to think that any Christian couple that I have an opportunity to minister to would get married without understanding what God considers an equal yoke. I think they would be lacking something very, very, very vital. Then there are special problems that will come up. Problems like parental disapproval, problems like premarital pregnancy, problem like mixed marriages. And by that I mean whether saved, unsaved, or racially mixed, or extreme spiritual levels of interest. Frankly, I've known couples that were both believers, but effectively it was an unequal yoke. They were so far apart in terms of spiritual interest that it was appalling. You need to understand that, and you need to help them assess that. Cultural backgrounds may be greatly varied. There are some issues in what I would consider mixture in marriage that you will need to look for and perhaps give a lot of special help in those areas. The area of mental illness and physical disability, I'm amazed how many times at the time of marriage, couples begin to think like this. Ooh, they've got a cousin who has a physical birth defect. Oh, is this going to affect my children? Is this something genetically that's in me? And so on. And they know somebody in his family that's had a pretty serious chronic problem with depression and whatnot. Ooh, is this... You know, it's amazing how many times at the time when they get serious about marriage that couples begin to think about these areas. And you may need to give them some help. Obviously, you may need to refer them to a good medical doctor. You may need to make some referrals here. But there are some specific issues, and if you really open a good dialogue with couples, they'll feel free to talk about the things that concern them. And you may help them a great deal at this point. And particularly the area of communication problems. If a premarital counselor doesn't do anything else, they ought to be alert for the need to help people learn to communicate. Our culture does not give that to us. We are an information society, and we cripple ourselves in open, sincere, honest dialogue. We don't learn to talk to one another. And existentialism has gripped the younger generation, and we let it all hang out, but we don't really know how to talk with each other. A dating relationship becomes a counseling relationship, at least by the second date, and that is not dialogue. That is not opening of one's life to the other. Now, there are some things that will help you. By the way, age is not a disease here. It has to do with things that will help you in the process. I've offered you a bibliography here. We need to stop. You may want to use one of the instruments you can learn as a non-professional person to purchase and administer the Taylor-Johnson Temperament Analysis. In many, many communities, training sessions are offered to people who are, you don't have to be a psychology major. Anybody who is an adult can learn to use this instrument. It's a very good instrument to use in the premarital context. And, of course, the Otto Smith, as I've given it to you, there are others, like the California Marital Readiness Evaluation. There are a number of instruments available for those of you who are interested in this area of life. There are some things that can be used to help you in the process. Now, we've chewed up all this time, and we haven't gotten interaction. But let me encourage you to make a ministry out of premarital counseling. At least have one person in your local church who is prepared and who is willing to spend some time with a couple who is getting married. Please don't rush young people to the altar without some help. Please do not assume they are thinking biblically about marriage. because our culture is not thinking biblically about marriage, and most of our young people are not. I tell you that by experience. We need to get some help to them. God helping us. Blessings on you.